Kuno Podcast, episode 16, for Monday, January 3rd, 2011, 2010, the year in review, anime style, part 1, death. Well, happy new year, everyone. Hope everyone had a great holiday, and we wish you all the best for this new year. The song you're hearing might sound rather familiar to you, because it's the melody of the traditional New Year's song, Auld Lang Syne. Except this is the Japanese version. And they call it Hotaru no Hikari, which literally means glow of a firefly. This song is traditionally sung at graduation ceremonies and at the end of the school day. And it talks about hardships that students must endure in their quest for knowledge, starting with the light of the firefly, which the student uses to study by in the absence of any other light sources. It's also used as the ending song for a spectacle that NHK, the Japanese broadcast network, puts on every year called the Kohaku Uta Gassen, which literally means red and white song battle. Basically, it's a sort of Japanese battle of the bands kind of thing. NHK throughout the year picks the most popular artists of all stripes, everything from J-pop to Enka, and puts together two teams, one composed entirely of females, the red team, and the other composed completely of males, the white team, who then proceed to battle it out. The winner is decided by a combination of official judges as well as a popular vote. And of course, the team with the most votes wins. The show ends with everyone singing Hotaru no Hikari, and finally, just before midnight, they cut to various scenes at temples throughout Japan, showing scenes of people worshipping and welcoming in the new year. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that Anime Los Angeles is this weekend, January 7th through 9th, at the LAX Airport Marriott. Pre-reg is closed, unfortunately, so you'll have to register at con. Prices are $50 for a full weekend, $25 for Friday only, $30 for Saturday only, and $20 for Sunday only. And for the youngsters, they have the Parent in Tow system, where basically any child 14 or under who pays for a full membership can bring a grown-up for free. The grown-up doesn't have to be a parent. It can be an older brother or sister, uncle, friend of the family, neighbor, teacher, and so on. Guests of honor include Gina Biggs, author of the webcomic Red String, Helen McCarthy, manga expert and author of several books on the subject, including the Osamu Tezuka book we featured in the 12 Days of Christmasu, Patrick Seitz, voice actor on many projects including Italia, One Piece, Oran High School Host Club, and Helsing, Taliesin Jaffe, who's the ADR, or dub director, and of course, the inimitable Tadao Tomomatsu, toastmaster and all-around man about con. Of course, you'll also find the usual AnimeCon fair here as well. Rather nice dealer's room and artist alley, various panels and workshops, gaming, both tabletop and console, musical guests, karaoke, cosplay masquerade, AMV contest, cosplay gatherings, and much more. The event schedule is online, so go ahead and check that out. And yes, we will be running two of the aforementioned panels. If you've ever come home after a day of taking pictures at con, only to find that you've ended up with a big old bag of hurt, come to Convention Photography 101. Here you'll learn the tips and techniques that'll really help you improve your cosplay photos. That's on Friday at 3 p.m. in LP3, Imperial A. And if you've ever wondered how this whole podcasting thing is done, we'll show you at Anime Podcasting for Beginners on Saturday at 4 p.m., again in LP3, Imperial A. You'll learn that not only is podcasting easy and inexpensive, you probably already have everything you need right now to get started. Now on to the show. So we thought we'd get together and do a year-in-review type thing, anime style. 2010 was quite a year of ups and downs, both in life in general, but also in the anime industry specifically. Unfortunately, this year we lost a few very notable figures, and in this first part of our two-part look back at 2010, we look at the deaths that affected us as anime fans the most. We thought it would be best to start with the depressing stuff and work our way up from there. I did want to bring up one death that we forgot to mention, though. On November 26th, notable anime director Umanosuke Iida passed away at age 49 of lung cancer. Iida directed many notable works including Helsing, Tideline Blue, Mighty Space Miners, and CB Kara Nagai Go World. And he took over the direction of Mobile Suit Gundam The O-8th MS Team when its first director, Takeyuki Kanda, passed away mid-production. He also did storyboards for several other works, including The Big O, Birdie the Mighty Decode, Tetsuan Birdie Decode, Brave King Gao Gai Gar, Final Grand Glorious Gathering, Cowboy Bebop, and Jinrei and Shangri-La. Anyways, let's get on to part one of 2010, the year in review anime style, Death.
We lost a fair amount of people in not just anime, but in related fields this year. This was kind of heavy with losses. So I guess that's what we first need to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one that I think hits home the hardest is the loss of Satoshi Kon. A very famous anime director. He worked on a number of just simply awesome titles. Perfect Blue, Millennium Actress, Paranoia Agent, and I believe most recently Paprika.
Yeah, and Tokyo Godfathers.
Yes, Tokyo Godfathers. Just fantastic themes in his works, dealing with a lot with the kind of the meeting and the melding of sort of the real and the kind of fantasy / dream / alternate world.
You know me. I'm into that sort of thing. It's it's like the mind frack anime. Insert different adjective to replace frack, is perhaps my favorite sort of anime, and it's he was a master of it.
Absolutely. His first work, Perfect Blue, there are some people that say that it's kind of more Hitchcockian than Hitchcock himself.
Yeah, I would say that's correct. Although it's interesting about Hitchcock, I think a lot of people who don't have like a technical background in film, they don't realize how close to the animation workflow what Hitchcock was doing. I mean, he was one of the first directors to thoroughly storyboard his movies out. Mm. He would completely work things out on paper, and it's like that's commonplace now. But when Hitchcock started doing it, it was absolutely unheard of, except in animation.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked very closely with Saul Bass, who did a lot of his opening sequences, and some beautiful modernist animation from incredible stuff. I mean, I don't think that, for example, the James Bond films would have started with one of those those animated title sequences had it not been for what Saul Bass had done for Hitchcock.
Right.
It's like Hitchcock, he did things in a lot of respects like animators do.
Mm-hmm. And his loss was very sudden. In May, in May he was diagnosed, I believe it was May, he was diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer, given only 6 months to live, and he passed on in August at only 46 years old. Very sudden, very, very tragic.
Yeah, pancreatic cancer is perhaps the fastest moving and hardest to cure cancer there is. I mean, the guy who did his final lecture, the gentleman who was
right, Randy Pausch, yeah,
he was a computer science instructor at
Carnegie Mellon, I believe.
Carnegie Mellon, yes. And yeah, he was facing down pancreatic cancer, and it's like I mean, some people, they survive. The Steve seems to be in fairly good shape now, when it looked like he was at death's door for a while. And right now, say a little prayer for Aretha Franklin, because she's got that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, I thought that what Satoshi Kon did, explaining himself in the, you know, in the no uncertain terms, and, you know, the message he left to, the people who were fans of his work, it's just, you know, remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he faced his death with dignity and courage.
Absolutely. And but man, this one really, it really affected the community. There's such a wonderful outpouring of emotions, and one in particular, the organizers of the Otakon convention. They worked with Madhouse, who was Satoshi Kon's longtime studio, and they put together a sort of a farewell project where they basically invited people all across the world to write messages of support that were delivered to Satoshi Kon's family. And I thought that was just very admirable and really remarkable.
Yeah, it's like a lot of people talk smack about anime fandom and about the whole otaku thing, but the fact of the matter is that even though you have people who maybe don't have the greatest social skills, I think American animation fans are more social than Asian anime fans. It's like we're good folks. We come together, you know, when we need to come together, and you know, we kind of it's kind of one big one big family.
Definitely.
Especially in situations like this.
Definitely.
I think I want to mention, on this list, we lost a very important figure in American comics quite recently. The writer Harvey Pekar, his story of, being a writer of comics and, having a day job and, having his life as a writer and his life, being just average Joe working 9 to 5. He passed this year, and, it's like, as well as American Splendor, which a lot of people are familiar with, not just from the series of graphic novels, but also from the movie. He also wrote sort of a diary of dealing with blood cancer called Our Cancer Year. And he survived, I think it was lymphoma. And, he survived that, but unfortunately he didn't survive other demons, and he had an accidental overdose of antidepressants, and big loss.
That's terrible. It's awful. We actually lost a few sort of important figures in the spread of anime fandom here in America. Peter Keefe, who was the producer of a series that we know as Voltron, but was actually sort of cut together pieces of two Japanese anime, Beast King Go Lion, right, and Kiko Kantai Dairuger 15. And, Voltron is one of those sort of the early anime to cross over into the States, including, other examples like Star Blazers and stuff. But interestingly enough,
G-Force.
Yes, yes. What Peter Keefe did is kind of also what another famous figure in American anime fandom did. And we're talking about Carl Maychek.
Carl Maychek, yes.
Who very, very controversial, but I would argue, you know, that, you know, yes, Star Blazers, G-Force, Voltron, et cetera, were famous. But I would argue that probably the most well-known example of anime crossover, and probably the one that I would argue started the most people's journeys into fandom, was Robotech.
Yeah, definitely Robotech.
I remember coming home from school. This was mid-80s, I believe, 85, was it? I was in grade school. I remember coming home one day, flipping around, and I saw, what is this? This is really cool, and it got me hooked, you know, episode after episode. And I was talking to a friend about it, and he's like, oh, that's this. Oh, here, check this out. And he handed me a stack of videotapes, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is that, you know, it's sort of compartmentalized. In Japan, Super Dimensional Fortress Macross was a huge hit. The other two series that were melded into Robotech weren't as popular, but that was a huge hit. But also, Robotech kind of boomeranged across the Pacific, and when the time came to do an extension of Robotech, Shadow Chronicles, it was done with the complete cooperation of Tatsunoko.
That's right, yeah.
And it was, you know, I think that if I'm not mistaken, Robotech is seen as a completely different series than the things that it was mashed up with.
It is, yeah, definitely.
And however, Robotech aside, the most important thing I think that that Carl Maychek did was work with Jerry Beck, who is a animation historian and you know, also kind of a producer in his own right, and started a company called Streamline Pictures.
Yes.
And the idea was to get this adult-oriented, and I'm not talking about Prawn here.
Right, adult in terms of themes, story elements.
Animation for grown-ups.
Right.
You know, although they did do a few kid-oriented things as well. But they had a really incredible, eclectic sort of series of movies that they put out between 1988 through to 1997. And, you know, we're talking about they were the first people to put out Studio Ghibli's work in America. You know, Totoro, you know, Laputa, Kiki's Delivery Service. These were all, you know, they put this out, Castle of Cagliostro.
Right.
You know, and, you know, Nadia, The Secret of Blue Water, which was Gainax.
Mm-hmm.
And 3x3 Eyes, which was the same guy who did one of my favorite series of all time, All-Purpose Cultural Cat Girl Nukunuku, did 3x3 Eyes, and they got that out.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's like they brought out some of the most interesting and eclectic. I mean, Twilight of the Cockroaches. Where would you place that in the history of anime. It's just, you know, one of those oddball things, but they put it out.
Right.
Robot Carnival. They put that out. You know, that's out of print at this point. You know, if you, you know, the VHS copies of that are going for, you know, scary bucks.
Yeah.
You know.
Not quite over 9,000, but pretty close.
Right, right. And they were the people that introduced GoGo 13 to America, you know, and Fist of the North Star. You know, they knew that people loved action, and those were action. They even put out one of the first ecchi things here, Wicked City. That would they first put that out at the behest of Troma. And yeah, it's like tremendous. You know, you go go to Wikipedia and enter in Streamline Pictures and look at this honor roll of what they put out.
They were basically the first anime distributor here in the States. That was they were the first company created specifically for licensing and distribution of Japanese anime titles here. And you know, if they didn't exist, you know, the landscape would be tremendously different, I would say.
Yeah, and they brought the they brought it. You know, I think that anime would have had a harder time getting out if it wasn't for them. And they made a fundamental decision that they were only going to do dubs. And this pissed a lot of the real...
The old school fan base.
'Cause in the days when... You only could have one format out there on screen. Not like they had a hard drive with two different versions of the movie,
right?
With dubbed and subbed, and this was also before DVDs.
Yep.
You know, you had to have on a VHS tape either a dubbed version or a subbed version. There was no. You know, there were no binary choices. It was you know, you couldn't say yes. It had to be one or the other. And they made the observation that most people in America do not have the patience to read subtitles while watching a movie.
Yeah.
And... You know, the truth hurts. The truth hurts, you know, and yeah, they pissed people off by not doing subtitles, but what could they do? They didn't have the resources to put out two separate tapes.
Right. I mean, that's just costly and wasteful. And I would argue that, you know, at that time, the American fandom, you know, the burgeoning fandom wasn't ready for subtitles, you know, I would argue.
Yeah, although, I mean, you had the hardcore fans.
That's true, yes.
Who were brought up on tapes that were mailed to them by Japanese without dubs or subs, and people would have these mimeograph sheets that they would follow.
Right, because this was before the internet. I think this was even before Usenet even. I mean, Usenet existed, but people didn't have access to it.
It was very interesting at Pacific Media Expo. The guy who's been running Pacific Media Expo is one of the guys who were like part of this hardcore in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And he was giving out these very old perfect bound books that were put out in 1991.
Those are awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like this was the stuff that was going on before.
Right. This was before DVDs. This was before the internet. This was before H.264, you know, MPEG 2.
This is this is the frontier.
Stone knives and bearskins.
That Carl Masek, that he and Jerry Beck were on with Streamline Pictures, and the frontier he was on with Harmony Gold. And it was also, you know, the frontier that another gentleman who we lost recently, Peter Fernandez, who was involved with Speed Racer. He was the voice of Speed Racer.
He was Speed Racer, all intents and purposes.
But, yeah, he was involved not only with voicing Speed Racer and voicing other characters, but he was actually writing behind the scenes. He was actually writing the American versions of these stories that, that we all grew up with. I mean, he was not Go Mifune, but he was Speed Racer.
Mm.
And, you know, it's like I still, you know, absolutely crave, you know, if somebody would put Mach Go 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 out, you know, nowadays with a standard anime sort of release, you know, maybe, you know, Funimation or somebody else could put it out, you know, so we can see what these shows that we grew up with actually look like in Japan and sounded like in Japan. I don't know if anyone's done that. I could be wrong, but I don't think anyone has.
Mm.
I think what we know of Speed Racer in America, well, Peter Fernandez shaped that in a lot of respects. He also, you know, he actually appeared in that wretched movie. I mean, you know, he had nothing really to do with that, you know, with the Wachowski version that looked like, you know, a video arcade blew up.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, I think he had a cameo role in that. But, yeah, you know, we have a lot to thank for. We have a lot to thank him for,
mm-hmm.
because of the fact that he was involved in this Wild West, situation where you know a lot of these, you know, formative documents of anime, these shows that came out, you know. Who did Mach Go Go Go?
I don't know. You got me there.
I know it was not Mushi Productions, but you know, it came out in the same era as Mushi Productions shows like Kimba, Amazing Three, and Astro Boy came out, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think Fernandez had something to do with the American versions of those as well.
Mm.
But, you know, here I am. You know, we try to do as much homework before we do our things, but here I am dropping the ball on this. Sorry about that.
That's okay. We also had a couple of other Japanese deaths.
Yoshinobu Nishizaki.
Yes, definitely interesting in the Chinese proverb sense of the word character. One of the co-creators of space battleship Yamato. We talked about Star Blazers earlier.
Yeah, huge show.
Huge show, and didn't he claim copyright or something? And there's this huge. He kept waging war against the other guys trying to forget what the backstory is with him.
Yeah, and it's like he got the people at Gynax pissed off at him. And then, of course, there was this very strange relationship he had with Tezuka Sensei and with Mushi Productions. You know, he kind of screwed him good. It's like there's a lot of controversy about the demise of Mushi Productions and how much or how little Nishizaki had to do with it. But the really weird thing about his death,
yeah,
he was on a research ship, and apparently somehow or another he had helped bankroll this thing or something, and the ship was called Yamato.
Some would call that karma. Some would call it, I don't know, something else.
But yeah, he was a man overboard, and
in more ways than one.
Yeah. And I strongly suggest that you follow some of these links from Otaku USA magazine and Patrick Macias. Patrick Macias, his blog, because he has some very strange stories about him that came from, you know, certain people he's friends with, and it's interesting tale, yeah. I guess you could call it Tokyo Babylon. It's like we had Hollywood Babylon. Somebody's got to write a book about Japanese animation and manga scandals and call it Tokyo Babylon.
Oh, yeah, seriously.
Hollywood Babylon.
Yeah, and of course, links to all the links we're talking about will be in the show notes.
Absolutely.
Let's see. We also lost Katsuhiko Kato, a famous composer who wrote the song "Do You Remember Love," which is like the cornerstone of the Macross movie "Do You Remember Love," and sung by Mari Ijima. And a real duh moment here is that NHK announced his death mere hours before the first of two Macross crossover live concerts featuring Mari Ijima and various other singers who did work for Macross. And you might have wanted to rethink that a little.
Yeah. You might want to, like, put a hold
show some class here, people.
Welcome to the NHK.
And let's see, a few others. Shojuro Yamauchi, who was basically did a lot of work on a lot of famous works like Castle of Cagliostro, which you mentioned earlier.
Yep. One of the movies that got their from Ghibli that got their first introduction to American audiences thanks to Streamline Pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Irvin Kershner, the guy who directed Star Wars Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
The one episode of Star Wars that's considered the finest of the six.
Yeah.
He had a lot to do with the reason why that was such a well-paced, snappy, you know, engrossing movie.
Definitely.
You know, it's like, I hate to hate on Lucas, but it's like, you know, his fires were kind of dimming after the first Star Wars movie, and
yeah.
it was absolutely a genius move on his part to get other people to direct, because, well, you know, as the prequels showed, by the time he got to the prequels, he kind of lost his mojo as a director.
Mm-hmm.
But Kershner, you know, old school movie director from the Hollywood tradition, man, you know, he whipped that that movie into shape. And it's like every time you think about Star Wars, that's the first thing that comes to mind, that movie. And in fact, it is now in the registry of classic movies that the Library of Congress has committed to preserving.
Mm-hmm.
And it just got put on that list this year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And finally,
Takeshi Shudo.
Takeshi Shudo, the father of Pokemon.
Mm-hmm. So, gotta catch them all.
Yeah. So we definitely a year of losses, you know, that affect us anime fans. This was also the year of the Tokyo Youth Bill. This thing has been like the sore on your left butt cheek that just will not, you know, go away.
a boil on the body politic of anime.
It started out basically, I forget the exact wording, but it started out very kind of specifically targeting kind of the depiction of youthful minors. I forget the exact wording of that. And
imaginary youth or something like that.
Something like that, yeah. And every time this thing came up, it has been struck down. Fantastic show of solidarity from the anime and manga industries. A lot of mangaka and, you know, various other figures, you know, kept on the warpath on this thing. But finally, through some manner of trickery, they managed to pass this sucker, and in the process, they kind of expanded it a lot. And when the blogosphere got wind of this, it sent everybody into a tizzy. But is it something to watch out, be wary of? Is it doom and gloom, or is it just a tempest in a teapot?
Well, I think for one thing, it kind of marginalizes Tokyo, because this is not... What people don't understand is that this is not a law that was taken up in the Japanese Diet, you know, the Japanese equivalent of Congress. This is a bill that was passed by the equivalent of the Tokyo City Council. You know, I think it's going to directly affect people in Tokyo. I mean, that's a huge part of Japan.
Yeah, Comiket, the big doujinshi convention, is, I believe it's going on right now at Tokyo Big Sight. And there a lot of, apparently, if I'm reading the news right, a lot of people are refusing to attend on protest, a lot of the sellers and stuff.
Yeah. And I suspect that what's going to happen is that Osaka is going to pick up the slack. You know, Osaka.
Come to us. We've got convention space too.
Yeah. It's like they have this longstanding tradition of being the place where Japan does business.
Right.
And so you know, my fearless prediction for 2011 is that all of a sudden a lot of these, a lot of these big anime events wind up in Kansai rather than Kanto. You know, they wind up moving. And it's like Danny Chu on the AX Live broadcast a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that was good.
He did not sound like he was extremely worried by this. You know, it's like, of all people, he would have his finger on the pulse of the industry pretty strongly. And he seems to think that it's very similar to in the U.S., if you go into a 7-Eleven, you know, you're going to see things like Playboy on the rack, but behind a shield. It's a news rack that's got like an opaque piece of metal that you know, that has the Playboy logo on it, and people know that's where the Playboys are. And what's going to happen is that a lot of anime on DVD, a lot of manga is going to wind up being under the counter as opposed to being out front.
So in other words, people who want the stuff, they'll be able to get it anyway because they just ask the salesperson, right, or whatever, hey, give me X, you know.
Yeah, it's going to be like, you know, when we still had video stores on a, you know, on a huge scale, there would always be that cordon off area in the back of the video store where all the naughty videos were. And you'd have to show your ID before going into that part of the video store. You know, it's like, I mean, it might be like that, but then again, you know, we could wind up with a knee-jerk reaction on the part of a lot of companies and so forth that are going to, you know, it's like businesses are risk averse.
Especially Japanese businesses, they traditionally do not respond to risk very well.
Yeah. And you know, they may wind up pulling in their heels and deciding, okay, this project, we're not going to go forward on this. We're going to wrap this project up. We're going to, you know, put the kibosh on this, on that. Mm-hmm. Sorry, guys. You know, it could wind up being, I don't think it's going to be as bad as the people that are screaming the sky is falling about this this whole thing. But it's
something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, and also, I think it's going to make a lot of people very risk averse. It may wind up having a chilling effect on certain types of anime and manga.
Right. Yeah.
And speaking of other ways that there's chilling effects going on, we're in the middle of a real realignment when it comes to how our anime comes out.
Yes. Peter Payne, Mr. J-List, said it best. He pulled out a quote from Babylon 5. It was the year of rebirth, the year of great sadness, the year of pain, and the year of joy. It was a new age. It was the year everything changed.
Exactly. I mean, this is not just limited to anime and manga. This is also going on in Hollywood motion pictures. It's going on in the European movie business. It's going on in Bollywood. It's going on in other parts of Asia. Anywhere where there's a media industry, we are looking at a situation where it looks like the trend is going away from physical media. I think that this is in some respects, it also exists in audio media as well. Yeah. You know, it's like most people get their music now not from a record store, but they get it from iTunes. They get it from
Amazon MP3.
Amazon MP3, that's my favorite.
Oh yeah.
You know, I love I love the fact that you get quality MP3s that play on just about anything, and their variable bitrate, you know, they're right there and they're inexpensive. I mean, the best album of the year, you know, I'm going to let you finish. But the best album of the year was CeeLo Green's The Lady Killer.
Mm.
Yeah, he was the guy who did that song. Well, the radio edit version of it was Forget You.
Insert other four-letter word beginning with the letter F in its in its place.
Yeah, and that song was like not only a hit, you know, of course it could not be a radio hit in its
original form.
But it became an internet meme, which is even more profitable. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is that when the whole album came out, it was full of awesome stuff that, that were equally full of win. and you go to Amazon.com and it costs five. Right. It was costing $5 for a while to download the whole album. You know.
Yeah. And yeah. The music industry hated this. They threw hissy fits. And I think they're finally now, you know, 10 whatever years later, finally starting to accept the inevitable. But they still don't like it.
They still don't like it. They don't like the fact that people refuse to have music with digital rights manglement, with the impediments to copying that also are impediments to having your music on whatever device you want it.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, the whole thing with digital rights management, manglement, defective by design media is, you know, it's like people don't just listen to music on their CD player anymore.
Right.
They've got their phone. They've got their iPod. Some people have iPods that are phones. Some people, you know, they listen to it on their computer at home. They've got a nice USB key with music that they like to listen to at work. You know,
they have, you know, streaming, you know, wireless music things like the Sonos going to their home theaters. They, you know, people listen to music in a variety of different means.
And people want to have home servers for all their media.
Right.
And the thing about the MPAA and the RIAA is that they have frustrated the development of media servers.
Yes.
Because of the fact that they're concerned. And I mean, their concern is actually in some respects quite rightful about the you know, people putting them on also on their on their BitTorrent share.
Right.
And letting the world, you know, letting World Plus Dog grab it.
Right.
And, you know, it's a balancing act.
It is, you know, and their attitude is basically like, you know, we are guilty until proven innocent.
Yes. Yes. And it's
very frustrating.
It's very frustrating. But then again, on the content provider side, you know, you have these tremendous, huge movies like, say, Avatar or like one that we're going to talk about later on, or I'm going to talk about it because you haven't gotten a chance to see it yet, Tron Legacy.
Yes.
You know, that are like, you know, they cost, you know, over $9,000 to make.
Yeah.
And they're scared that these blockbusters are going to wind up, you know, on somebody's share, and everyone's grabbing it, and World Plus Dog gets a free copy, and they don't get Bupkis.
Right, but the ultimate fallacy of all this is that, I mean, the dedicated pirates, they're gonna get it no matter what. I mean, look at DVD. You know, it was cracked by DVD John in you know, just a few days, and he wasn't even in it for stealing. He just wanted to watch his DVDs on Linux, which didn't support DVDs at the time.
Exactly.
But I mean, these, you know, Russian, Chinese, you know, hacksaws, they're gonna break the encryption. They're gonna make some backroom deal with take the video camera into the theater. You know, the stuff is gonna get out. You know, nothing is gonna stop the dedicated thief.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is that the people who are really doing this with impunity are like the Mexican mafia, the Russian mafia, the Yakuza, you know, any number of organized criminal enterprises. I'm not sure what they call it in China, but there's organized criminal enterprises that basically work with a nod and the wink from the local constabulary because they've been bought off. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that have pressing plants and that press, you know, DVDs, and, you know, you wind up with these perfect copies. You know, it's like you go down to Santee Alley in downtown Los Angeles and you will find pressed copies of movies that are still in theaters. Mm-hmm. And they were all done in Mexico thanks to La M A.
Yeah, and especially for the anime industry, there's a tremendous business in pirate anime. If you take a look at the pirate anime FAQ, the pirates have gotten really good. I mean, they're able to almost perfectly duplicate, the special holographic stickers, they're getting good. But
the Hong Kong triads, that's what they do now. The Hong Kong triads used to be all about drugs and stuff like that. No, they're about coming up with pirate DVDs.
Yeah.
And I'm sure pirate Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. No doubt we'll start seeing that, as the Blu-ray technology gets cheaper, but with all this going on, we are starting to see a shift in the way anime as well as other forms of media are being distributed, in that we're now really seeing a push towards online distribution. I mean, look at Crunchyroll. They're like the darlings of the anime online distribution biz.
Absolutely, and they started out as a pirate site.
Right,
but they went legit.
They made a lot of deals with the content providers, and everybody seems to be loving it.
Yeah, and the fans love it. The content providers get their share of money, and it's all good. And the thing is, why didn't they come to this 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Why didn't they, why weren't there people with foresight in the industry who could see that something was going to happen and that people were going to want portable media that they can take anywhere?
Right.
And, it's just, I live in Los Angeles. I live in the San Fernando Valley. I live very close to the beating heart of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And, they didn't have to be running scared like chickens with their heads cut off.
Yeah, yeah.
They could have listened to some of the people who were talking sense and talking about the idea of, people being able to pay, like $10 a month to stream all you can eat movies, mm-hmm. to their computers that they couldn't, store. Spend some more money and get media that they could put on their home server, that they could put on their time machine network disk, and stream it to their iPod, stream it to their Mac.
Right.
You know, Windows, on the Windows side of things, they have similar architecture with Windows Media Player and with these NAS boxes that you can have why did it take them so long to realize that instead of being a vampire at their necks, that this was money in their pocket? It's mm-hmm. like, and this is not the first time they've choked. It's like the guy who was head of the MPAA, a guy named Jack Valenti.
Oh, yes.
Was very famous when Beta versus VHS was the big war.
Yep.
As far as content, he was in front of a congressional committee and he said that the VCR is to the movie industry what the Boston Strangler is to the woman who is home alone. I mean, how much scaremongering can you get? I mean, that was so choice that, not until Fox News Channel came on the air did you hear a scare line that was well crafted and scary, you know?
Yeah, and what did the VCR end up doing to Hollywood? It made them money hand over fist.
Indeed. You know, first, you know, you had these video stores that were paying $100, $200 per copy of a video and renting them out, and people were renting them and they were, you know, voracious in their renting. And then Disney came up with a bright idea. Hey, why don't we lower the price a little and do these limited runs of stuff in our back catalog? And we'll call it sell-through video because it's priced to sell through. And guess what?
You had
little kids going, Mommy, Mommy, Pinocchio, Pinocchio. And, of course, you know, there is no power stronger than the power of a nagging little kid.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, Mommy, Mommy, get me this. Mommy, it's a Lion King. Mommy, Mommy, it's Toy Story. You know, and you know that this title will be going back into the vaults after like 6 months of being out. So you better move fast on this. Come on, people. So you had limited time, low prices, and the fact that, you know, kids loved it. And there were the adults who were like, oh, wow, this is something we can collect. And so you have these people now who still have their shelves full of those white clamshell boxes with colorful labels. And, yeah, I got the first release of Kiki's Delivery Service. Yeah, I got the one with the subtitles, man. You know, and the first release of The Lion King. I've got that. I've also got the second release. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Gold mine!
Yeah.
Gold mine, people. And the thing is that I'm sure you're aware that people have that same kind of collector instinct when it comes to music. And when it comes to movies and TV shows that they download, you know, it's like, dude, I've got like, you know, terabytes of all this awesome stuff, man. You gotta see my iTunes playlist, man. I got everything. You know? It's like, people, People, have some foresight.
Yeah.
And, it's like, it's not just people like Crunchyroll, Anime News Network, and so forth that are doing these streaming things.
A lot of the licensors themselves are doing their own thing.
Yeah, and Funimation has been leading the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a lot of their stuff available. I mean, and it's not just on their site. They will put stuff on YouTube. YouTube! You know, it used to be that YouTube was the thing everyone was scared about. Guess what?
Yeah.
And they have stuff on Hulu. You know,
yeah.
there's any number of venues online now that have varying levels of protection of content, and you know, it's like these companies are finally realizing that they can say, okay, let's put the old stuff that we don't care about, let's do an official release on YouTube, let's get all these really bad encodes off of the site, and let's put some, you know, good copies of Bewitched or whatever, you know, or Kimba the White Lion or whatever, you know, and put them on places like YouTube, you know, so that people know, you know, that's their first destination on the web oftentimes. But let's put some of our more protected content, you know, newer content, content we want to keep closer to our vest. Let's put that on Hulu.
Right.
Let's put that on, let's set up our own site where we can pay for this stuff with some commercials and such.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like they're starting to get it.
I think so. Yeah, it's slow and painful, but I think they're starting to get it. I'm definitely seeing that move towards online. Netflix? Reed Hastings, Netflix president, basically came out and said a couple years ago, you know, in 10 years we won't be doing DVD. And this year we're starting to see that they now have a streaming only plan.
Yep.
And you know, they're on basically every set-top box known to mankind. And
yeah, you can buy a DVD player, and a lot of people are just getting DVD players because it's one of the cheapest ways of getting their Netflix stream.
Right.
You know, it's not like they have like a whole bunch of Blu-rays lying around.
Right.
You know, they get it because they want to hook up an Ethernet cable to the back of the thing and get on Netflix.
Exactly. And I've been actually doing a lot of research on this because I am hoping to finally complete my Enemy on the Cheap feature that I did like over 9,000 years ago. But, you know, it used to be that in Netflix's anime collection, it was laughable. But now it's really grown. They're getting some good stuff.
Yep.
And you know,
and
at the same time, you know, now we're seeing, you know, the physical brick and mortar places really starting to dry up. You know, we lost Tower Records, we lost Sam Goody, which was the place to buy anime back in the day, and now finally, Best Buy has made the decision to stop selling anime. They're going to sell out their remaining stock, and they're going to, you know, rejigger their DVD thing. So
I think Fry's is doing the same thing.
I've seen an awful lot of sale, you know, big sales of Doom there.
Yeah. Although they haven't made any grand announcement. Fry's tends to keep things very close to the chest. They're a family owned company, and so they're able to do that.
Right.
When you're publicly traded, you have to be a lot more open.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, I'm somewhat concerned at all this because really, The problem with streaming, you know, getting digital content is that until we get some fundamental issues like net neutrality straightened out, you know, getting some actual competition in the internet service provider space, you know, streaming is just not viable. I mean, I recently moved from Santa Maria, and when we were living there, we had DSL Extreme. It worked really well, except for streaming. It was just not fast enough. And, you know, I'm now lucky that I've got Cox Internet here in Carpinteria, and the streaming works wonderfully. Michelle, you have issues with that as well, don't you?
I have physical plant issues here. I live in a building that has been told to me by people that this building that I live in may be as old as the late 40s.
Wow.
And it's certainly into the 50s, you know, and I've got very old wiring in the walls. And the thing is that you can only bypass it so far. Verizon put a jack in the kitchen where the actual ingress point is.
Wow.
For the main connection for our for the apartment. It's you know, they put in a new jack for me. But the thing is that considering everything with the wiring in this building, and eventually you have to deal with the wiring in the building that goes out to those block thingies that are outside. I can only get 1.25 megabits.
Ow.
Yeah. That's my headspace here. We're sucking it through a straw, folks. Mm. And the thing about streaming is that what I have to do a lot of times is wait for it to come in.
Hit pause and wait till the progress bar fills up.
Exactly. And I had to do it with TV shows. I mean, for the longest time, I recently did a rescan with my digital TV box.
Ugh.
And I finally got KTTV, which is the Fox affiliate. It's actually owned and operated. And also KCOP, which is the indie station that Fox owns. It used to be I couldn't get them with my digital TV. They finally, you know, boosted their signal, and now I've got them. But say I wanted to get my fix of the show that's been my guilty pleasure this year, Hell's Kitchen. I couldn't get Hell's Kitchen over the air. I had to either go to Hulu or to the Fox site to see, you know, my cooking show of doom, you know, to see who's pissing off Gordon Ramsay this week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, yeah, it's a trashy show. I know. I'm laying myself bare here by announcing my guilty pleasure to the world. But, you know, it's like my, you know, for the longest time, I was a major Iron Chef otaku. And, you know, it's like I don't get cable. You know, I can't afford cable. So it's either, you know, with Iron Chef, I don't even think they've got that streaming anywhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, you know, Hell's Kitchen. Yeah. You know, it's sort of like it. You know,
in a way,
you know, but it's more, there's more drama involved and there's more bleeped cursing. Yeah. You know, and you have more more food being flung around with Gordon Ramsay screaming, "This is raw." you know,
oh, yeah.
You know, but. you know, I for the longest time I had to get it streaming, and in order to do that, I would let it download and go about other business.
That's the only way.
Yeah, and it's like I could go the cable route, but you know,
yeah,
it's extremely expensive,
that
and
it is.
They know they have you over a barrel.
Yeah,
and as far as satellite goes, it's that's not even workable. You know, there's people out in the boonies where that's the only kind of broadband they've got, and there's so much latency that it kills whatever advantage
horrible
they had in bandwidth.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's like we are the cellar dwellers of the world when it comes to having internet infrastructure in this country.
It's
making
laughable.
It affordable.
It's laughable.
I mean, Finland has made it a right that people, you know, a human right that people get 10 megabits into their home. And they have it so that in like 2015, that will go up to 100 megabits. You know, enough to saturate most people's routers. And that would be a human right. And if you're not a wealthy person, guess what? You get a voucher from the government saying,
wow,
here is your internet. You know, and sorry that it's so slow. You know? I mean, there are still people in America that have to deal with dial-up. I mean, come on, people!
It is laughable. It really is.
And politics alert: you can fast forward through what I'm about to say, but we have been cheaping out on infrastructure for so long, and we are in need of major stimulus spending in this country to get us out of this. Let's face it, folks, we are in a depression right now. You know, it's like if you look at U6, which is unemployment data that is more closely resembling what people looked at as unemployment data during the 30s. We have 30s level unemployment. We have 25% unemployment. We have 50% unemployment in the ghettos.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the same old, same old. And rather than boost our spending and to heck with what the rest of the world thinks. We are a sovereign nation. We can print money, and we're going to damn well do it, and we're going to put people to work. We are going to have a works program similar to that which existed in the 30s and gave people hope and gave people paychecks. Instead of doing that, and instead of tinkering around the edges with healthcare is one of the things that is weighting our economy down the most. Instead of tinkering around the edges with reform that only turns out to give these private insurance companies, you know, a vacuum into your pocket, you know, vacuum hose in your pocket. It's like we could have had single-payer health care where you have a great big pool for the entire country, everybody in, nobody out, from birth to death, and we could have solved this problem. But instead, We have had 30 plus years of the Reaganite mythology of, you know, supply side economics. You know, George Herbert Walker Bush totally hit the nail on the head when he called it voodoo economics, because it's just about as scientific as voodoo.
Yeah.
And we have been, you know, living under that conventional wisdom ever since. And every time there's been a change of guard as far as political party, the Democratic Party, which has labored under the false characterization of being tax and spend hippies, you know, that they're off in cloud cuckoo land, and they're smoking their weed, and they're taking their LSD, and they're doing it. You know, they come off of their LSD trips and say, "Hey, this is what we got to do for the economy." The thing is that, you know, the Democratic Party has drunk the same Kool-Aid that the Republicans have. And we've got a mess, and we're not getting out of it anytime soon, because in spite of what Obama has said, what he said on the campaign trail, the hope and the change and all that inspiring words, in the end, he's just another one of them. Them. You know, I don't know whether that's been thrust upon him. I don't know whether that's, you know, what his whole thing was all along. I think it's probably a little bit of both. But what is being done in this country is exactly the opposite of what should be done. And to get this back on topic, you know, it has everything to do with our infrastructure, and the internet is part of our infrastructure. You need the internet, for example, to apply for jobs.
Yeah.
And you can't just go to the library, because maybe you don't have a library nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you don't have a car, so in order to get to the library, you have to get on the bus. And, you know, the bus is like the slow boat to China. So your expedition to the library takes the better part of a morning. You get there, you have to wait in line for access to a computer. You know, it's...
And the thing probably doesn't work right, because they don't have enough money to pay for IT staff, and the thing's all infested with spyware and crap.
Exactly, exactly. And it's like you need a broadband connection at home. You need a computer at home. It's just, it's as vital now as having a mobile phone. There's a lot of people that don't have landlines anymore. There's a lot of people that don't want to get landlines. But, you know, if you go to the store, you can get a prepaid, phone. You can get a card to fill up your phone with minutes,
mm-hmm.
and you're online, you know, you're on, and that's your phone. And I mean, you don't even need a roof over your head for that.
Yeah, they even have a prepaid EVDO, mobile broadband. It's wild.
Exactly. But the thing is that's all well and good. But that's a very expensive way to do it. What we need is broadband infrastructure in this country.
Yeah.
We need to modernize our rail. We need to modernize – we need to fix bridges. I mean, it was not this year, but last year we had a bunch of bridge collapses in one small period of time. It just seemed like there was a cluster of them. It's like our infrastructure is going to heck in a handbasket.
Definitely.
And meanwhile, we have people who are out of work, who are losing hope. You've got people who have lost their unemployment lifeline because they've gone 99 weeks without having work. Mm. And you have two parts. If you brought those two parts together,
yeah,
you could solve these two problems easily. But the thing is, it takes money. It takes an investment in the common weal. Yeah. And America's not about that. America is about, I got mine, Jack. You got your bootstraps. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I don't give a darn. You are.
Yeah, very, very short.
Lazy bum.
Very short-sighted.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why we're in the place we're in. Anyway, have we gone over this distribution
I think so.
Well enough, although actually as far as distribution goes, there's also the question about the biggest distro, the last one standing almost, Funimation.
Yes, apparently earlier this year they were their parent company, Navare, was looking to sell them. And I don't see anything more recent than September, but as of then, they still haven't found a buyer. At the same time, though, it seems like they're not – Funimation isn't necessarily slowing down. I mean, they still maintain strong presences at the various anime conventions that they've been at, grabbing releases left and right. They're turning out to be sort of the savior of lost licenses. I think they came out with, I don't know, over 9,000 old licenses from like Genion and stuff.
Yeah, and then there's the incredible disappearing ADV, which may or may not be gone.
Yeah,
it may have remorphed somehow.
That's a weird one.
Yeah, it's like what's up with that? Nobody knows. I mean, it's been broken up into like several different holding companies, and they released a bunch of licenses which wound up getting snapped up by Funimation.
Mm-hmm.
However, who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, Funimation is a big problem because they've gotten so much of a monopoly. They are quite literally too big to fail as far as anime goes.
Mm.
And so there's been nobody talking about sales. You know, there mm-hmm. supposedly there was like five or six offers made. But the announcement of the offers happened with no suitors identified and nothing. Crickets.
Yeah. It's a big mystery.
Although they're doing some wonderful stuff. I mean, this whole save thing, SAVE.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I just got myself complete series here. Welcome to the NHK, Comic Party Revolution, and Beck Mongolian Chop Squad.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually pricing them at sell-through prices.
Yeah.
Which is something that I've been screaming about for years and years and years. Anime, look at what Disney has done.
Yeah, yeah.
Although what's funny and what's the biggest ironic thing of all is that when Disney releases a Ghibli release, they release it for like, premium prices, the same kind of premium pricing that Geneon and Bandai did in their prime.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still stuck with that.
Yeah.
And so what happens when people are priced out of getting the superior Disney releases? They wind up going to a place that might have the Hong Kong version of a Ghibli release.
Yeah.
And Disney just lost a sale.
Yeah.
stupid.
Yeah.
Stupid. It's like I want to have that chorus from South Park. Dum 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 dum.
Yeah.
You know, every time I bring up one of these issues where it's just corporate stupidity,
it was ridiculous. I mean, back when I first got into it, you know, when anime DVDs first came out, it was like $30 for a DVD with like maybe 3 or 4 episodes on it, and you know, for a 24 episode series, that's like 6 discs. It was absolutely ridiculous, and I think they finally got it now. So now we have, not only do we have series coming out, you know, in their entirety instead of piecemeal, but we actually have, you know, thin packs and various box sets at actually somewhat reasonable prices.
Yes. Yes. And occasionally they will put something out for fetish fondle value in a premium sort of packaging. But most people go for the thin packs because that's what fits on their shelves.
Right.
You know, and you know, what can I say? You know, it's funny. It's like one title that came out as a save title, and I got to pick it up, is Furikuri.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you remember when they first put out Furikuri?
Yeah, it was like over $9,000 practically.
Yeah, $30 for one disc that has 2 episodes.
It was ridiculous.
So you have to buy all 3.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Anyway, let's move it forward here. Let's do a quick retrospect of anime conventions this year.
This is our first year going to PMX, and you know, you've if you haven't heard the episode, go download it. But we liked it.
Yeah, PMX was fun.
It was a relaxicon.
It was a cute little con. It was sort of like what Anime Los Angeles used to be.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just you know.
It was very
mellow.
Probably the least amount of stress I've ever had going to an anime convention.
Yeah, and it helped that they were in a really nice environment. Pasadena is a nice place.
Nice place. It was a fairly pretty safe area. It felt like they had some various food choices, and if you had to do the hotel food, it was actually not that badly priced as far as convention food goes, and it was actually fairly good.
Yeah, and they were also bringing
the food trucks in, which were uber popular. Next year they really have to tag team them.
Yes, absolutely. And well, ALA 2010 was fun too. It's getting bigger.
It's still got a very friendly feel to it, though, and mad props to Chaz and his crew for keeping that feel.
Absolutely, and they do some things that you're not going to find at AX. You
right.
know, you're not gonna find a con suite.
Yeah.
Where people go and just get munchies. And, they appreciate people coming in and bringing in donations of things to stretch things out, you know. So so if you're at Anime Los Angeles, sure that you throw some goodies their way, or at least, you know, put a nice big tip in that tip jar.
Absolutely. Con suite is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an old tradition from back in the day with science fiction conventions, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the ALA difference is that this is a convention that is run by people who have been running conventions since the 1970s.
Yeah, yeah, they've been around the block a few times as far as convention running goes. Which is why it works out so well.
Yeah, I mean, when they have bugs in the system, they listen to the people who come to the gripe session at the end of con.
Yeah.
They listen to what gets said, and they tinker with it, and they fix it. You know, it's like there was a period of time where there was a little problem with the security staff, but then, you know, they wound up, you know, changing the whole vibe of what the security staff was going to do and how they were going to do it.
Right.
And you had, they're called the Fairy Godfathers.
Yes.
And, you know, suddenly you wind up with people who used to have a chip on their shoulder suddenly realizing, okay, we gotta be nice here.
Yeah.
And they have to remember constantly that these are fellow otaku and you treat them right.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to other bigger conventions who shall remain nameless, you have people who wind up getting their Hitler trip on.
Yeah.
And, you know, walking around like tin horn dictators. And, you know, basically causing more harm than good, especially in an environment where there are few official security guards because the venue is running on a shoestring because it's run by the city of Los Angeles that's in a hideous budget crisis.
Yeah.
You know, we're not naming names, but read between the lines, folks.
Yeah, although I will say that they that certain organization at least is trying. It's been a lot better than it has been in past years.
That's true. And I think that what's helping is that they get on the internet every week and they do a show.
Yeah.
And they get people emailing them in.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like there's more of a flow of information. Maybe this certain con, AX, you know, maybe it'll be a lot better next time.
It's going to be interesting because, you know, we had this new, you know, super corporate guy, Latanzio, however you spell it, come in, but now he's out again. So, you know, next year's AX is going to be interesting. In the same, you know, this year's AX was interesting because, you know, because of Latanzio's arrival, and boy, they sure pulled out all the stops in terms of the guest list, didn't they?
Yep. And turns out that some guests actually enjoyed themselves to the point where they're going to be back this year.
I believe Danny Chu said he'll be back next year.
Yes. And actually, he was talking about that right after he returned from AX. You know, he was talking about that, and that's why I you know, jumped on getting my AX membership.
Yeah.
Regardless of, you know, wondering how am I going to stay downtown all that time. You know, and after being yensed by a certain person who shall remain nameless, who was supposed to be my roomie, but bailed on me and left me holding the bag.
Ouch.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know how I'm, you know, you really do have to stay within a few miles of the venue.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I live in the valley and going downtown every day for con, for something where you have events going into the night.
Yeah.
You can't do it. Yeah. You can't do it. Yeah. You know, unless you have a car. Mm-hmm. And then with cars you have to deal with
traffic and parking.
So, you know, there's really no way to do it upright without having a base of operations. And the problem with downtown LA is that a lot of the places, you know, you have the expensive places and you have a few places here and there that are that are inexpensive but still kind of pricey.
Yeah.
But then you have the prices dropping way down.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be a dead giveaway for you when you're in downtown LA that those places are places that you don't want to stay.
Run away.
Just so everyone knows who is not an Angeleno. There are hotels. They're called single-room occupancy hotels, and they are basically there to keep homeless people off the street. And they are real inexpensive, but the fact of the matter is that they are ghetto as heck.
Yeah, yeah, definitely avoid, like, the plague.
You have to be very careful where you go. I mean, we found a nice little place called the Kawada that seems to be very well run, even though they're in a building that's probably about 100 years old.
Yeah.
You know, which has its charms. Let me tell you, it has its charms.
Yeah.
But basically, the place was laid out to Japanese standards of what's and European standards of what rooms are supposed to be sized.
Yeah.
The Holiday Inn, it is not.
Yeah.
You know, it's not even the freaking Motel 6.
But it worked.
It worked. But the thing is that you have to be careful because once you get a little bit below that $109 right. a night.
Then you go into scary land.
Yeah, then you go into you know, these places where you have people you know, puking in the in the lobby, and you don't want it.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
People from New York City will also feel what I'm saying right now. But the fact of the matter is that people come to AX from all over the country, and they need to know these things.
Definitely.
Because, you know, because they're used to, you know, the inexpensive Motel 6 down the road. And trust me on this, you know.
You ain't in Kansas anymore.
Heck no. Heck no. Or even Missouri.
Yeah.
Hi, Liz.
So AX was also our first time at running panels and workshops. And what, boy, was that a rush or what?
Oh, it's awesome. It's awesome. And we get to do this at Anime LA.
Yes.
Yes.
I'll announce that in the opener. But wow, we did it. I was floored by our podcasting workshop in particular. I thought it was doomed to failure because it was the night, last day of con, the night after, you know, the morning after Masquerade, and, you know, presumably
9 o'clock
in the morning, after like probably a heavy night of people partying and stuff on last day.
We are programmed against Danny Chu.
Yes.
We are programmed against Danny Chu. However, 50 people showed up at the panel, and
it was wonderful. Like I said at the panel, oh my God, there's people. I can't believe it. I think those were my exact words.
Yeah, we thought that we were going to be doing our spiel for the sound guy, and that was it. And
yeah, I thought I would have a repeat of my podcasting panel I gave at FanimeCon, where I think there was a total of one attendee, and he was a friend of ours.
Okay, and that gives us an interesting segue point. Fanime.
Yeah, we've got to finagle some way of getting you up there one year, because I think you'll like it, because it's a weird mixture of the kind of buzz of Anime Expo, but with a more down home feel to it, like Anime LA. It's very curious because, I mean, it's big. I mean, this year's attendance was, I believe, 20,000, but there was none of the attitude. It was very friendly run, and probably because they still are an organization of fans. The FanimeCon's tagline is "By fans for fans," so they keep it real.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a secret master of fandom that's helping to grease the wheels. Somebody from, like, the sci-fi fandom community that's helping them and being kind of the graybeard who solves problems.
Certainly wouldn't surprise me. But it was just It was great. It was the San Jose Convention Center. The panel lineup was very diverse. You know, all sorts of weird, you know, fan, you know, topics that you wouldn't see at a more mainstream convention, like, you know, not just, you know, the doll stuff, but also, you know, doujin, a lot of the Toho project, which is a sort of doujin fighting game series, which is relatively unknown outside of, you know, the fans that are more into it, you know. They had a really interesting and diverse lineup of panels, and it was fun.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's Northern California.
Yeah. Yes.
And I mean,
and I could get there by myself on public transportation, and it was not scary at all, even at night. The San Jose trolley literally stops right in front of the convention center, and then the trolley also stops at the San Jose Amtrak station, which is also the Caltrain station, so you can pretty much get from anywhere to anywhere.
Yeah, that's lovely, and especially considering that Donald, you have special needs, and yeah. It's like usually with an event like Anime Los Angeles, I have to, help get you to get you there and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, helping you get places, you know, without you getting lost. And it's good that's set up in such a way that everything's intelligent and everything works. Yeah. And everything's accessible.
Downtown San Jose, there are two hotels literally physically connected to the convention center. Those are the longtime official convention hotels of AnimeCon. There's plenty of food of all different types and prices. I mean, this is downtown San Jose, so there's
that was also the place. I have fond memories of my time when the .com boom was booming, and I was at some internet service provider convention because my work was basically rolling out their whole spiel, and it was great being in San Jose. It was wonderful.
Yeah, we really have to get you up there one of these days for Fanime. I think you'll like it. I really do.
Well, you know what? There is, and the fact is that what we do, it doesn't come cheap, and we do this because we love it, and we do this because, you know, we want to do this. We're totally otaku about doing this podcast. That's yep. why it's called Otaku No Podcast.
Yep, exactly.
However, just to, you know, let people know that there are many ways that you can donate to show your appreciation. One way is to go through our little box on our site with a search engine that goes directly to Amazon.com and buy your stuff through them. We'll get a little cut of it. There's, you know, ways of contributing to us via PayPal. You know, we don't do the whole Twit thing where we take little bits of money out of your account every month. Although surely if you want to set up a monthly donation, there are ways of doing it through PayPal that does not involve us, and you can do this. We are not rolling in this stuff. We are not independently wealthy, and help us.
Yeah, we do it. I mean, we do it because we love anime and the fandom. I do it because I love playing with geek gadgets like microphones and USB audio interfaces.
So do
and
I.
Things.
We're both,
there we go,
both
yeah.
a couple of geeks.
There
I
you
mean,
go.
I'm not known as Ms. Geek for nothing.
There you go.
But, you know, I hate to be rattling that... that cup, but everyone knows that these are hard times.
Yeah.
Make it a little bit easier on us.
There you go.
That's all.
Yeah. Well, that does it for part one. If you got any comments, please send them to us. You can email us at feedback@otakunopodcast.com. We've got Skype call-in lines. You can tweet us. You can comment on our Facebook page. There's all sorts of ways to contact us, and all those can be found on the Contact Us page at Otakuno Podcast. Also remember that there's full show notes, all the links to the stories that we talked about and stuff on the Otakuno Podcast website, as well as the products that we mentioned. Check those out as well. So like I said, part two will come out later this week, probably on Wednesday or Thursday or so. So be sure and check back then. Hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll see you next time.